Welcome! You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
In Canada's perspective, one of our main industries is the extractive industry, be it mining, resource extraction within the oil industry, to help with deregulation and provide corporations, multinational corporations, a stable, secure environment in which they can operate. And so free trade agreements basically set the framework for that and provide what many call an architecture of impunity to corporations.
That was the voice of Common Frontier's Raul Bourbano. He speaks to us about the ongoing repression in Honduras and the caravan for the upcoming elections, and why, as people living in the north, we should pay special attention to what's happening in Honduras. Stay tuned.
We're very privileged this morning to be joined by Raul Bourbano. He's one of the organizers with Common Frontiers and one of the key organizers for the People's Social Forum coming up next year in 2014. Welcome to our program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Sylvia. It's a pleasure to be here as always.
Now, tell us a little bit about your work with Common Frontiers. What is Common Frontiers and what are its objectives?
So Common Frontiers is a collective of a working table which encompasses various organizations, Canadian organizations, so predominantly labor, civil society organizations, and ecumenical organizations. A lot of our work has been around looking at the impact of globalization across the Americas, its impact to workers, to communities, specifically the negative impact, clearly, and we look at proposing alternatives to these type of corporate-driven policies, i.e. things like free trade agreements that really have nothing to do with trade, but are more about consolidating the rights of corporations at an international level, looking at the impact of Canadian investment in the Americas, and also how do we link that back here with in Canada, with how that's impacting workers. So globalization impacts workers in the global south, but obviously workers here in Canada, communities, women, you know, indigenous communities. That's part of the work that we do here in Canada and in the Americas.
It's important that you point out the interlinking connection between oppression, imperialism, and capitalism. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how these relationships unfold, particularly when we look at the relationship of trade and mining, for instance, and the communities that are impacted. Can you maybe paint a picture of what are some of the examples where these relationships that you're making demonstrate the kind of inequality and injustice that this plays out?
Oh, for sure. So, for example, free trade agreements, really the goal of free trade agreements is to provide corporations, in Canada's perspective, one of our main industries is the extractive industry, be it mining, resource extraction within the oil industry, to help with deregulation and provide corporations, multinational corporations, a stable, secure environment in which they can operate. And so free trade agreements basically set the framework for that and provide what many call an architecture of impunity to corporations so that corporations can act without, any ramifications from civil society and the laws of those countries. So it really, it's facilitating and providing the legal framework for corporations to reap and steal the natural resources of communities in Canada. We're talking indigenous communities and also in the global south. It's been linked to displacement of communities, violence against human rights, environmental organizers, labor. So these are some of the challenges that free trade agreements have. They also allow corporations to challenge local legislation, be it environmental, labor, any kind of legislation that would impede the ability of corporations to do profit or to do the work in their country. And they would do this in external tribunals. So we're talking about not tribunals that are run out of the World Bank and are headed by individuals, not relevant to, you know, any of the countries that are necessarily involved, and they make decisions that could potentially bankrupt small countries who don't have the resources to pay. So it's really a way for corporations to privatize and impose legislation that normally is difficult for them to get imposed in countries. So, for example, if in Canada, many people are pointing to the deregulation of the environment, the Lakes Initiative. So that is a way of allowing for corporations to come in and expedite the extractive industry in Canada. So deregulation allows for that. And, of course, you know, within the free trade agreement, if you have too many regulations, it could potentially be sued in international courts. So it has very close relationship to corporations wanting certain things and governments, local and international, supporting those through a legal framework of trade agreements that really have very little to do with trade. And it's about deregulation, privatization, removing the role of government within any aspect of government, of civil society life, and really just delegating the role of government to, you know, policing or something like that.
When we talk about government, it's important to recognize that while the political system and electoral processes are imperfect, they tend to reflect the desire of populations to have governments that are for the people and of the people, that are in, you know, trying to eradicate some of this impunity. Latin America, in particularly, has had a history of violence, a history of dirty wars, a history of impunity and mass murder that still marks today our relationships with trade, our economic relationships with foreign countries. And in many ways, this is the path of imperialism, where one nation, like the United States, feels that Latin America is simply its backyard, and so they can impose whatever conditions, inequitable conditions of trade, on the people. So when we have elections, those elections are not just an electoral process to put in place a new party that will be less inclined towards a corporative agenda, but it's also in many cases in Central America, in particular El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, these are the sites of resistance. Can we talk a little bit about the significance of the electoral process that is taking place right now and what's at stake in the country of Honduras, for example?
Well, if we're talking specifically about Honduras, it's important to just kind of reflect a little bit on the recent history of what's taking place in Honduras when, in 2009, the democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya was basically deposed by a coup d'etat. It was posed as a constitutional crisis, but the reality was that Manuel Zelaya was proposing to do a consulta, popular consulta, which was something the community had wanted. And of course, that's something that the right-wing establishment locally and internationally could not handle at the moment. So he was basically, you know, whisked away in his pajamas, kidnapped, and then, you know, a right-wing sort of government of Micheletti was implemented that restricted all civil society rights, and started with repression, murder, and assassination that has continued during the government of Porfirio Lobo, who was elected basically in January of 2010. So what we've seen, and this has been documented by, you know, organizations like Amnesty International and other organizations, is as targeted assassinations, murder, political violence, and that's the context currently that for the last 3-4 years that Honduras has been living under. And during the 2009 election, the resistance, which is made up predominantly of labor organizations, i.e. teachers, Garifuna communities, Campesino, all different civil society organizations did not partake in the elections. But this year, in November of this year, with the new election taking place, civil society, and not all civil society, so we need to be clear that not all civil society in Honduras see the elections as the road forward, but an important component of it does, and they've decided to partake in the electoral process. And so, they've organized themselves basically under a political party called Libertad en Refundación Libre, which, you know, has put forward the ex-wife of Manuel Zelaya. Zamora Zelaya is the presidential candidate in the 20s, in the elections coming up. But it is important to note that, you know, in the last few months since she has proposed her candidacy under the Libre Party, there has been political attacks against, you know, six Libre Party activists, including candidates, have been murdered. So we see an increase. I mean, Honduras is already considered a failed state, murder capital of the world, journalist, murder capital as well, LGBT violence against the communities down there. So what communities and organizations are saying is that there's going to be, and there has been, escalation of violence against communities who are organizing in the political process. And that is obviously of significance to anybody who cares about human rights, who cares about, you know, a somewhat legitimate democratic process. And that's something that we are hoping to partake in Honduras.
As you point out, the importance of remembering that history, that very recent history of the military coup in June 2009, it's not just the increase in violence. You know, we see violence everywhere, but for a country, the per capita murder rate has completely escalated, given it the name of the repression capital of the Americas, you know. And I want to talk specifically about the reason why looking at the history is important. Long before there was Occupy, you know, an Occupy movement in North America, this idea that the 1% shouldn't control all the wealth and that the inequality that exists as a result is not justifiable and can no longer be tolerated, there was the Aguan Valley. So long before we had this Occupy movement, the Aguan Valley region was setting an example for the world as to what community organizing sustainable subsistence economy could look like. And I wonder if you could talk about the kind of models of resistance we are learning from the Honduran people.
Well, I think the whole Frente de Resistencia was an important model in terms of the length and ability of bringing together a variety of groups under one umbrella to be able to challenge and to be able to resist and to be able to propose new ideas against an oppressive regime, whether it be labor organizations, community organizations, working as a collective across the country, forming, you know, community-based initiatives from, you know, organized from the ground up, run by communities, you know, many of them indigenous, many of them women. And I think that's some of the biggest lessons that we're learning is that, you know, it's not always the political process that's the most important. First, you have to have a strong community organizing, political base at a grassroots level, so we're talking community, whether it be in Bajo Aguan or in Tegucigalpa, you know, communities have to come together to understand what are their challenges and how can they work together to solve them, and then build sort of local and national structures to challenge that, which is what the Frente did. And in terms of a resistant movement, I think it's been an inspirational movement across the country. I was there in 2009, just after the coup, and as I traveled across the country, you could see communities organizing at different levels based on their resources, based on their knowledge, whether it be the Garifuna communities in the north who were protecting their land against encroachment, whether it was the environmental communities or campesino communities fighting against the impact of Canadian mining in the region, to labor organizations, teachers unions, students coming together, all understanding that their causes are linked and that, you know, what they saw, which was the deposition of their democratically elected government, although, you know, many had told me that, you know, Zelaya wasn't necessarily their first choice, but that rupture of democratic process, which they had decided upon, was a key component that brought them together to struggle against a right-wing, what I would call fascist government in Porfirio Lobo.
Common Frontiers is organizing a group of people to come and be observants to this election. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Sure. So I was probably a few months back, I was listening to Berta Olivia, who runs one of the organizations called COFARE, which is the Committee of Relatives of the Detained and Disappeared in Honduras. probably the most well-known human rights organization in Honduras. And she was testifying before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights back in March. But she was talking about how an organized campaign at a national level of murder, intimidation, and impunity is taking place across the country. And it has been escalating due to the rise of the elections, because, you know, the elections do put a lot of power in play. So she had asked, in her, from her perspective, there is sort of, you know, there's a coordinated, you know, process with death squads linked to governments that are starting to target, coordinated and on a national level, you know, political activists, environmentalists, anybody who's sort of opposing the current structures. So the call kind of came up from her indirectly that, you know, civil society or international communities need to come and support as much as possible during this period of time. Not because the elections is the most important time, but elections is when political violence intensifies. And of course, there's also the opportunity where there's media spotlight on Honduras, and that, you know, with international observers there, the goal is that some of that media attention could be diverted. The reason I think why for us it's important is that if you read in the news, you know, you mentioned correctly that, you know, Honduras is, you know, the murder capital of the world at this point. Most of that violence in the mainstream media, if you look at the news, is attributed to drugs, gangs, and I think that's incorrect. Definitely some of that you can attribute to it, but many people do believe, especially people organizing in Honduras, that a lot of this violence is state organized violence, so targeted political repression against members of the Libertad, communities that are organizing against transnational capital, you know, members of the Frente of Resistance. So it's not just gang related violence, not just drugs. So we want to, with our experience there, is one, to educate ourselves as we meet with civil society organizations, be it labor organizations, campesino community, student movement, to understand, you know, the reality of what's going on in Honduras, but also to kind of shift the discussion a little bit from just, you know, violence, but also how does Canadian investment, whether it's mining investment in Honduras, for example, Canada has helped to rewrite the mining code in Honduras, which has made, you know, Honduras now, in essence, a pro-mining, corporate social responsibility type of country based on the legislation. And it's no coincidence that the Canadian government has been very quiet and silent on the human rights abuses, the violations in Honduras, and through the back door has been very supportive of continuing to do business in Honduras, at the expense of what many believe of human rights. So we want to kind of, we would like to kind of change the spotlight a little bit on Honduras, a failed state because of gang and drug violence, which is kind of the narrative of the North, and I think it's really supported by the Canadian government, and kind of shift the spotlight on what is really going on, which is not only that, but it's also state repression, the influence of multinational corporations, and obviously for us, Canadian investment, whether it be Gildan Activewear, Goldcorp, the corporations that are down there that are helping and are preparing under a free trade agenda that would really open the floodgate, maybe you believe, for Canadian investment in the region, specifically in mining, where many have said that a lot of the mining concessions in waiting are, you know, going to be given to Canadian corporations. So Canada has a lot to gain from a regime that continues to repress and humiliate the people of Honduras. And I think it's important for Canadians and sort of international observers to, one, support an electoral process that, you know, potentially could be legitimate, and if not, to sort of be able to condemn that, but also to follow the communities and understand what they're doing so we could share that story back. And I really believe it's linking it to what's happening here in Canada, because what's happening in Honduras, obviously at different levels, is not that different than what's happening here in Canada. So, for example, the free trade agenda that has been imposed on Honduras and impacts, you know, communities in Honduras, also impacts communities here in Canada. So, for example, the Upachafic First Nations people of Vancouver are fighting the free trade agenda of the FIPA, the Canada-China free trade, right? So looking at how these trade agreements do not consult and indigenous communities when it's, you know, when the resources are under their territories, and it's basically giving concessions to multinational corporations. No different than teachers in Honduras who are struggling today, who are being fired, who have their pay being cut, the same fight that Ontario teachers here were fighting against the Liberal government. So we see those links. It's not something that's just happening in isolation. It's a global trend, and I think we can learn a lot from each other so we can bring a lot of that back, share the stories, and build links between our common struggles across the Americas and across the globe.
I'm so glad that you raised the issue of mining, because I remember the wars in El Salvador, and, you know, during the dirty wars of the 80s, we heard a lot about Canada's role as the peacemaking nation, and Canada was this broker of peace. You know, they wrote many of the peace agreements with El Salvador and Honduras and all these places. And one of the key areas, as you point out, was these trade agreements that increase the importance of mining as an economic engine of the country. And in the case of El Salvador, this has proven disastrous. El Salvador, however, is the first example of a country who has declared a ban on mining. And I wonder if you want to comment in contrast, just to offer a contrast, the response that that it has received and the kind of aggression that it's faced with, as you know, for taking this courageous stand.
Absolutely, that is an important point. El Salvador currently has a moratorium on any new mining in the country, and the interesting part is that Canadian mining corporations, for example, Pacific Rim, is using the threat of legal arbitration against it for El Salvador not providing it with mining concessions. So we see how these international tribunals, Pacific Rim is now suing, in conjunction with other American corporations, is now suing the Salvadoran government for over $350 million in international tribunals, saying that, you know, you didn't provide us, we've done everything we should have from an environmental perspective, and you haven't provided us with the mining, so hence you're violating, you know, this free trade agenda. And I think why that's so important is that it goes to show you that even if you have a progressive government that would enact what the people in the country want. So in El Salvador, we saw the reason why the government, whether it was under the FMLN or prior to the right-wing government of El Salvador prior to the FMLN, had also implemented a ban against mining, right? It was done because of the communities had organized. Communities at all levels came together, fought. I mean, we're talking about repression and communities, you know, activists were killed, but we're talking about a very well-organized community of resistance across the country, again, built on a network of solidarity within the country, but on an international level, and they were able to put enough pressure, even on a right-wing government at that time, to put a moratorium on mining, and of course, with the FMLN and Mauricio Funes, that has continued, but the transnational corporations have put a lot of pressure, i.e., potentially could bankrupt El Salvador with some of these international tribunal lawsuits that, you know, you could potentially twist the arm of any government to concede to mining. But I think the importance of El Salvador shows us a model of resistance on a national level that has been successful and continues in that struggle because they understand and they've lived the impacts of, you know, whether it's Pacific Rim or whether it's the environmental damage in other communities from U.S. Extractive industry.
One of the most important things that I've gathered from our discussion this morning is that the importance of recognizing the interconnectedness of the struggles, you know, the interconnectedness of our struggle to protect water as a resource that belongs to everyone, to the people, that ought to be protected, not just for the people, but for all the sentient beings to share this space with us. I wonder if you could, in closing, tell us about the delegation to Honduras. Who is invited? You know, what do you need to know to participate? And, you know, I mean, how do people participate in a delegation as an observant?
Great. So we are proposing a 10-day delegation to Honduras from November 17th to the 27th. There are, I would say, a couple of major objectives in that. The first is that we will visit with the human rights groups in different parts of the country, whether it be in the Siria Valley of Honduras, where Goldcorp, its former San Martin open-pit mine, has impacted community health We want to meet with the local communities to understand and see how Canadian mining has impacted them. We want to visit women's human rights groups based in Choloma, the city where Gildan Activewear is located. We're going to be meeting with human rights organizations, with labor organizations, civil society organizations, Garifuna indigenous communities, you know, to understand their struggles and how we can kind of work together and link our struggles. The delegation is open to anyone. There is, you know, you have to cover your flight, but there is a whole itinerary that we have. If you go to the www.commonfrontiers.ca, there's sort of a call for people who are interested. You just have to fill out an application. You know, we ask some general questions. So we plan on doing that, but also the second important component of this delegation is that we are working to get official international observer status for the elections, because we will be there during the period of elections, presidential elections. So part of the delegation, or part of our work, will be once we've met with communities and traveled around and understood sort of the crisis that's taking place and how we can work, we're going to accompany civil society in their electoral process and be sort of an international non-biased observers of a process to be able to share that back to Canadian audience and those around the world. Our goal is that it be a delegation from, ideally from Canada, people who are within Canada, whether it be labor, indigenous, civil society, NGOs. So we are open to anybody. We do have limited spots, so unfortunately it's filling up quick, so if people are interested, they'd have to take a look and apply pretty soon. We are working in conjunction with various organizations. There's a Honduran Solidarity Network from the U.S. that's sending, you know, a dozen delegations to Honduras during this period. So we are working on a sort of national and America's way. And the goal is that people who are interested in continuing to build solidarity with the people of Honduras and the people of Latin America once we return. So, because part of the goal is, you know, not just to go and see and then come back, but ideally build strategies and see how can we continue to work together once we come back. And of course, everybody has different talents, and you know, everybody can utilize, whether it's media, whether it's through donations, whether it's through public speaking, in any which way that they feel that they can support. If they can, that's kind of the long-term goal of building solidarity amongst communities here. But there is a strong focus we'll have with looking at Canada's investment in Honduras, looking at the struggle of labor organizations, the impact to women, and then human rights, of course, and how Canada's foreign policy, either Harper policy of a free trade agenda, of quietly supporting economic development over human rights, of, you know, providing Canadian funds, whether it's through CETA or through a different organization or the former CETA, to support the training of Honduran police when the Honduran police have been implicated in murder and, you know, so we're looking at how those paradigms actually interact within Honduras and how we can take what we learn from there and from here and be able to share that back with the Canadian audience and work going forward.
Thank you so much for being with us. For more information on Common Frontiers, how can people access your work? How can people join the delegation to Honduras?
They could either send me an email if they're interested. My email is Burbano, B-U-R-B-A-N-O, @rogers.com, or they can just visit our website, www.commonfrontiers.ca.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you very much, Sylvia. It's a pleasure.
Take care.
You.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.